Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Could malicious software pose a threat to national security? And what have the good guys learned from the effort to contain a computer worm invasion that has spread to millions of computers in at least 200 countries? In the fall of 2008, computer security experts discovered a small, sophisticated program that had begun to insert itself uninvited into Windows-based systems around the world. Once installed, the worm that came to be known as Conficker gave its creators the power to remotely control virtually any machine it infected, putting at risk entire networks, including those maintained by governments and utilities. So how did a volunteer team of good guys figure out what they were dealing with, and what sort of progress did they make toward wiping out the worm? Journalist Mark Bowden is a contributor to magazines including Vanity Fair and The Atlantic. His new book is called Worm, The First Digital World War. Mark, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
We'll start here with some definitions. How is a worm different from a virus?
A virus is something that kind of requires you to do something stupid, like open an attachment from someone you don't know, whereas a worm can just work its way into your computer without you doing anything about it and without you necessarily even knowing that it's there.
And in some cases, it can get there even if you're not connected to the Internet.
It can if you plug in a flash drive that's been infected, or which happened at the Pentagon, onto a closed network, or if you pop in a DVD or something that could possibly be carrying it.
So what these worms do is allow somebody far away to control your computer. Is that right?
That's right. It basically, the worm itself only has a very minor function, which is to invade your computer and then to reach out to invade other computers on your network, and then also to send a message to its remote operator saying, I'm here and I'm ready.
And that's a lot of potential computing power for people who have access to this.
Well, it is. If you have a worm like Conficker, which spread rapidly, it was a kind of a genius of a propagator, and it eventually connected an estimated 10 to 12 million computers.
So in the fall of 2008, experts first started to realize something was up. Talk about Phil Porras and what he turned up in his honeypot.
Well, Phil is a computer security researcher at SRI International in Menlo Park, and SRI is a big think tank. One of the things that they do is monitor, Internet security and developments in the Internet. And he has a HoneyNet, which is basically a collection of virtual computers which function as a network. And it exists for the sole purpose of kind of snaring malware as it enters cyberspace. And so Phil keeps track of these things, and when a new strain like Conficker comes along that is not recognized by anyone, he and his staff get to work dissecting it and trying to figure out what it is and what it's trying to do.
And it was obvious from the beginning that this thing was spreading very quickly?
That's right, because, on Phil's monitor, which records each new piece of malware that strays into his HoneyNet, ordinarily, in a given day, he might get 100 to 200 new, or 100 to 200 strains, most of which he recognizes right away. But in fairly short order, Conficker was propagating so fast that it was shoving aside every other piece of malware, and it was the only thing pouring into his HoneyNet. So that was an indication to him that this thing was spreading very, very rapidly and was way out of the ordinary.
So being careful here, Mark, to use broadcast-appropriate language, can you tell us how this worm ended up being called Conficker?
Yeah, well, one of the first things that the worm did, and it's thought now to have been a dodge or a feint, was to contact a well-known spam distributing website called trafficconverter.biz. And the puckish programmers at Microsoft playing around with trafficconverter.biz sort of recombined the syllables and utilizing the German term, the crude German term for sexual intercourse, in order to create something that is a true, Conficker.
Well, it turns out that that name is certainly appropriate in terms of how much trouble this thing has caused people. How did Conficker make its way past the security defenses of Windows?
Well, actually, this is one of the more surprising and kind of alarming aspects of the story. Microsoft actually recognized the vulnerability that Conficker exploited months before the worm actually appeared. And they issued a patch for it urgently, out of sequence. Ordinarily, they issue security patches on the first Tuesday of every month, but this time they went out of sequence to get it out really quickly. And but what happens is that because most computer users, most people who use Windows, are not faithful about downloading their security updates, and then also because so many Windows operating systems are unregistered or have been pirated in places like China or Malaysia, where vast numbers of people use Windows without ever registering it with the home company, the security patch only reaches a relatively small portion of the Windows operating systems in the world. So once they release a patch of a vulnerability, it actually functions as a kind of an advertisement to the malware generators around the world that here is a vulnerability that we can craft software to exploit. And most Windows operating systems in the world will remain vulnerable, even though Microsoft has spotted this and patched it.
So it's like putting a sign on your front door that says, oh no, my lock is broken.
Exactly, and not only that, but it says it's the lock on the second window to the left in the basement, and the way you get it open is by jiggering it to the right.
So brilliantly, I mean, you have to say brilliantly, if you have to at least respect the intelligence of the people who did this, even as we really despise the crime. After exploiting that flaw in Microsoft, Conficker essentially turns around and locks the door behind itself.
That's right, because this is a competitive business, malware, and the people who created Conficker realized that they weren't the only ones aware of this vulnerability, and they didn't want to be, competing against other malware manufacturers for the same piece of ground, basically, in the computer. So once they worm their way in, they fix the opening for you.
So let's talk about how experts came together to try and figure out what they were dealing with here. What sort of networks exist to link these people who have an interest, either professionally or in many cases simply as very smart amateurs, to work on these sorts of cases?
Well, these are all folks with a shared interest in computer security, whether that is because they work for one of the big antivirus companies, and that's a whole rather large industry, or whether they're like Phil Porras, academics, or whether they work for Microsoft. Some of the people involved with this work for Microsoft, or whether they just are in sort of the security consulting business, and their job is to protect large networks. There are people scattered all over the world who have this very rarefied level of expertise. And when a threat like Conficker appears, it threatens everyone. And so in this instance, a lot of those parochial concerns were set aside in a very urgent effort to try to get this thing under control.
Do they have ways of vetting one another to ensure that they're not feeding good information about what they're learning to people who would use it irresponsibly?
They do, and it's a very small network of computer security experts who know each other. And the only way that you would get invited into what they call the cabal, the Conficker cabal, is if someone vouched for you, had worked with you, knew you could be trusted. That's the way you would become a member of that group.
And some of those who got involved were there because their businesses stood to take enormous hits due to this infection. Can you tell us about Rodney Jaffe?
Yeah, Rodney Jaffe is a fascinating guy. He's a South African by birth who's middle-aged now, so he sort of grew up with the Internet and has become one of the leading computer security experts in the world. He's an entrepreneur, but he has jobs, and the one, probably the most significant job he has now, is head of security for Neustar. And Neustar is a company headquartered in Washington, D.C., that functions as a sort of a directorate for web addresses for the Internet. And it also is responsible for the sort of trunk lines that control telecommunications. All the cell phones in North America are sort of routed through Neustar's servers. So Rodney, you know, his job is to protect NuSTAR's computer system, and he realized that something like Configer could actually just bring it down.
Yeah, it's sort of terrifying to think about what could happen if a system like that were hit. And it's interesting because it would be terrorism that had, you know, it wouldn't initially take a single life, but it could get in the way of emergency communications. This is a big deal.
It is a big deal. It would be tremendously disruptive, and it would lead to loss of life if you consider things like the air traffic control system of this country is rests upon a foundation of the Internet. A lot of, you know, traffic engineering in the country, the electrical grid in the United States, you know, all of the telecommunications, and you can imagine how many industries nowadays rely on instantaneous telecommunications, including surgeons who are in the middle of, you know, performing surgery in hospitals. So if the Internet itself is threatened, it really increasingly poses not just an inconvenience, but a real threat to the normal functioning of our society.
So hearing this, I would imagine most people assume that a major contingency within the cabal were agents of the U.S. federal government, but that's not the case.
You would assume that, and I did as well. And in fact, the members of the cabal originally thought that the government would, once they were alerted to the threat, would step in and really become, you know, primary partners or supporters. And in fact, the opposite was the case. They discovered that the folks responsible within the federal government for protecting the Internet and even for protecting their own government networks were in way over their head where Configer was concerned. They did not understand the worm. In many cases, they didn't understand the nature of the threat, and they ended up being of no use to the cabal in trying to stop it.
So as they start to learn more about this breach, the members of the cabal were still puzzled over who might be responsible. Initially, at least, some figured, well, maybe this is just some really smart computer science student messing around.
That was one of the theories at first, because the people who created Configer demonstrated such an extraordinarily high level of capability that a lot of these guys in the industry just found it hard to believe that someone outside of their own kind of academic or rarefied commercial environment would have those skills. But then after, you know, their initial efforts to corral the worm were met by a countermove by its creators, they realized that whoever was behind it was doing it on purpose and was out to, you know, to use it for some nefarious purpose. And that, in fact, they were just as capable as the top level security people in the world.
So this wasn't something that just accidentally got into the wild.
Well, that was the sort of hopeful thought at first, but once it started making adjustments to protect itself from the cabal's efforts, they realized that this was an adversary.
My guest this hour is Mark Bowden. He's a writer for multiple magazines, including Vanity Fair and The Atlantic. His new book that we're discussing this hour is called Worm, The First Digital World War. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, we welcome you to join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Mark Bowden. He writes for Vanity Fair and the Atlantic magazines and has a new book out called Worm, The First Digital World War. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org. Mark, another difference, as I understand it, between a worm and a virus is that with a virus, very often you start to notice the sort of deleterious effects on your machine right away. A worm might not actually cause any harm to the computer that it has invaded. Is that right?
Pretty much that's true. I mean, one of the things it does is, Chris, is it disables security updates. So from the date that the computer gets infected forward, you're essentially vulnerable to any new strains that come along. But basically, the worm doesn't want to hurt your computer. It wants to use it.
Hmm. So you start to have these people trying to understand how this thing works. And finally, it appears that they've sort of gained the upper hand by understanding how this thing is registering domain names. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, the way the worm contacts its controller is by sending a message to a domain on the Internet where the controller is temporarily residing. And one of the security features of the worm is that it generates randomly a list, at least at the first strain, a list of 250 domain names every day. And the controller only has to be behind one of those doors in order to communicate with the botnet. So the initial efforts to corral Conficker involved dissecting the worm so that you found, the researchers at SRI found the algorithm that generated these 250 new domains every day. And they were able to turn the clock forward and anticipate what the list of 250 domains would be each day. And so then the task became buying up those domains from the various top-level directorates and preventing the worm from making contact with the with its controller.
When you say top-level directorates, that's like .com and .uk and .edu, the ones that we've mostly heard of at the end of our addresses. Is that right?
That's right. Those are the top-level domains. And there are 110 countries in the world that have their own top-level domains, including .us. Most people in this country don't use that, but they are, for many countries, the primary server for Internet access.
So obviously sort of body blocking these domain names is a laborious task, but it was something that they were able to do, and they cost like $10 each, and so they were able to get out in front of this. But then something very strange happened, and Conficker figured out a way to get way past that.
That's right. The second strain of the worm came along and basically dared this ad hoc volunteer group to keep up the effort. And it upped the number of domains generated each day from 250 to, I believe it was, 5,000. And then they also added several top-level domains. So now the folks, Rick Wesson was really the fellow doing this for the cabal, had not only to buy up 250, but 5,000 domains each day. And in order to arrange that, he had to go to now five different top-level domains in order to secure their cooperation to enable him to do that rapidly each day.
And we should say that in itself was a huge achievement, to get all these companies on board working against this thing.
It was, and in fact, it may be the singular accomplishment of the cabal, which was to pull together various factions, industry, academia, and the actual software manufacturers, as well as the country domains and the top-level directorates, to all basically on a volunteer basis work together to try and stay out ahead of this thing.
What were the first clues to emerge about where this thing might have originated?
The first clue was that the worm was designed to essentially self-destruct if the computer it invaded was using a Ukrainian keyboard.
Hmm. And so that one would think that perhaps it was a Ukrainian behind the design of the software.
It is, and I think, you know, the thinking there would be that if you're Ukrainian and you're working, you know, out of the Ukraine, if you are not stealing from or invading the computers of Ukrainian citizens, you would be theoretically immune to prosecution in the Ukraine because you wouldn't be breaking any Ukrainian laws.
How does prosecution work on this sort of thing? If there, you know, there are international courts, but it's hard to bring people under different jurisdictions. Have we figured that system out yet?
No, it's very much a work in progress. And, you know, Conficker is one of the crises that has really sort of pushed for some kind of resolution. But, you know, the Internet has no international governance. And essentially, the laws vary from country to country. Some countries, you know, in Africa and different parts of Asia, South America, are relatively new to the cyber world and have made, in many cases, have no laws against cyber crimes. And, in places where there are laws, the level of seriousness with which they're taken, investigated, and prosecuted varies widely. So, you know, to tackle something that attacks internationally is a chore that the world has not yet learned to do.
And I guess there's also the issue of if you cannot prove people have suffered monetary damages, maybe even the laws wouldn't do much.
That's right. I mean, there are in countries like the United States, like Great Britain, and most European countries where the Internet is a fact of life, you know, laws have been drafted and enacted that deal with fairly sophisticated cyber crimes. But in many parts of the world, that's not the case. And that's why, you know, the folks who write malware and who perpetrate these global scams will move their operations to countries where, you know, they're relatively immune.
Let's go to the phones now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. We do have a couple of lines open. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll speak first on the line with Danny in Dallas. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Terry. For your
Chris.
Guest, just a brief question. I'm not sure if this is even logistically possible, but being that when the virus invades the computer, it recognizes the Ukrainian language and terminates itself, is there no way to worldwide give a quick blip to any online computer and send a Ukrainian false language to the keyboard so that the virus would terminate itself?
Well, that's an excellent suggestion, Danny, and it's theoretically possible. In fact, you wouldn't even need to do that. It's also possible for Microsoft to essentially send out security updates that would automatically purge any Windows operating system of Conficker. The problem is one of civil liberties. The companies and the government are restricted from entering into private computer users' hard drives and cores. And, you know, there would be a huge civil rights outcry if, you know, people's computers were being updated without their permission, even for something as seemingly important and innocuous as this.
Okay, we have an email here from Tom who wants to know how we can find out if our home computers are infected with Conficker.
The way to do it would be to, if you Googled Conficker Working Group, those three words, you would go to essentially the website of the Cabal, and you can download from there free diagnostic software, which would tell you whether or not your computer is infected. And Microsoft, as I said, has had a patch to protect your computer from Conficker that was issued even before Conficker was even created. So it's not that difficult to find and get rid of. The problem is that so many people around the world their operating systems are pirated or they are not aware of the security threat.
Talk about this. Could the Ukraine thing be a decoy? Has anyone discussed that, or is that it's just too much work to try and throw off the trail?
No, that definitely is a theory. You know, one of the big suspects was China, because China is notorious for providing illicit support to for cyber attacks and for the creation of predatory malware. And so a lot of the folks involved in the cabal, and I discussed this, it actually became quite a dramatic thing in the book because they needed the cooperation of China in order to try to corral Kunficker. But at the same time, a lot of people were suspicious that China itself might be behind it and that the Ukrainian keyboard thing was just a feint.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Jeremy wants to know, is it possible for Microsoft to use the Kunficker worm or one like it to install the security patch? I guess this comes back to the question of civil liberties once again. Computers.
It's definitely possible. It's kind of, I asked that question myself. And of course, at Microsoft, they just throw up their hands and say, do you have any idea what kind of legal problems we would get into if we tried to do something like that?
Is Microsoft at all liable for damage if it does happen down the line to computers from this vulnerability?
Well, it's a good question. I'm sure they would say no, but some members of the cabal have indicated that there's potentially an enormous class action suit out there waiting to happen because, you know, Kunficker exploited a vulnerability. It happened to be at port 445 on the Windows operating system, but it was exactly the same vulnerability that Microsoft had discovered years earlier at a different port and patched, and they hadn't taken the precaution of checking to see if that same vulnerability existed at other ports in their system. So they could have, you know, gotten even, you know, further out ahead of this than they did. But I think, in all honesty, you know, as I've said, the major problem comes from those who use Windows operating systems that they have stolen or borrowed or copied or pirated. And so many computers don't get security updates, and no matter what Microsoft does, it can't really, protect the world's, the Internet from this kind of thing.
So should people who are not using Windows operating systems assume that they are safe from this sort of activity?
Well, they're safe from Kunficker because it exploits the Microsoft system. But, you know, there are worms and viruses that attack Macs and other brands of computers, not to the extent they do Windows, because Windows is the big boy. And if you're going to, you know, design a global scam, why go after the company that only has a small percentage of computers? But, yeah, everybody who connects to the Internet with whatever kind of a computer is vulnerable to predatory software and is well advised to pay close attention to security updates and take appropriate security precautions.
So, Mark, when you get a bunch of geniuses in the room or in the same virtual room, as was the case, I suppose, with a lot of meetings of the cabal, it can't be that everybody constantly agrees with one another on the best way to proceed. Can you talk a little bit about how that all played itself out?
Yeah, I mean, there are egos involved and lots of suspicions. And, you know, the group that very heroically worked together to try to corral Kunficker had its share of internal dissents and suspicions, all of which played out in the Internet chat room that they set up to work together. And I was able to, in the research for this book, they actually made me a member of the Kunficker working group, which I thought was extraordinarily open and kind of them, which gave me access to their archives. And so in the book, Worm, I detail some of the back and forth between these folks as they sort of battled their way toward working together.
Did they ask for the right to look over your materials before publication and possibly redact certain things?
No, but they did ask, when they gave me access to the archives, they asked me to clear the use of any email with its author because they didn't want to violate the presumption of privacy because it was a closed network and the people who joined it sent emails to it didn't do so initially believing that somebody like me would come along and make, you know, their communications public. I have to say that in every instance where I contacted somebody and asked permission to quote from their emails, I was given permission.
We have an email here from Margot who wants to know, what is the benefit to the worm originators? Yeah, what do these guys get from this system?
The Kunficker botnet is an extraordinarily useful tool for stealing. What it does is it gives the operators of the botnet lists and lists of millions of computers around the world that are vulnerable. So if, for instance, I'm interested in a scam where I will steal personal data from, let's say, 500,000 computers. That means I want people's passcodes so that I can get inside their computers, that I can steal all their email contacts, so that I can send spam to all their friends, so that I can get their codes for their bank accounts and I can drain their bank accounts. What they'll do is they will lease a portion of Conficker's botnet, and they have then, the 500,000 computers that they know are vulnerable to a certain kind of attack, and they go after them. The botnet's creators make money because they lease out a portion of it, and I'm sure are paid a percentage of the proceeds from the cyber crime. There was a group in Europe just earlier this year that was busted after draining $72 million from American bank accounts. And that group utilized a portion of the Conficker botnet and presumably paid a fee for that privilege.
And yet there was this, they called it not D-Day, but C-Day, when the understanding was something very terrible could happen. What happened on that day?
Well, when the most sophisticated strain of Conficker appeared in 2009, it carried instructions to all of the computers to check back with the controller on April 1st, April Fool's Day. And because that was the first day that strain of Conficker would become active, and because it was a time when it would take the cabal a period of time before they could wrestle this strain of Conficker completely under control, it was assumed that if anything destructive were going to be done by this botnet, it would happen right then, right at the beginning. And, you know, the fact that it didn't happen illustrates that the people who created the botnet want to use it to make money. They don't want to use it to destroy the Internet.
And I guess we're just lucky in that.
That's right. I mean, the potential is there. Anyone with a botnet of this size could crash the Internet, period. But clearly, because that didn't happen, the people behind it have no desire to do that.
Mark Bowden is here. His new book is called Worm, The First Digital War. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Mark Bowden. His articles appear in magazines including Vanity Fair and The Atlantic. His new book is called Worm, The First Digital World War. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Eric in Arlington, who wants to know, was the Conficker worm able to automate its own domain registration process? Can that registration process actually be automated so that bulk domain registrations are possible? And additionally, Eric wants to know how people were reimbursed for buying up the domains out ahead of Conficker.
Well, Eric's got a great question there. Actually, it was the cabal that I think they did automate to some extent the purchase of domain names, and they were compensated to a degree, although Rick Wesson, who was the architect of this approach, ended up out like $30,000. The last line of my book is that, oh, by the way, somebody still owes Rick Wesson $30,000. The worm itself doesn't purchase those domains. It just, you know, attempts to contact them. It would be the operator of the botnet who would purchase one of those. Actually, now Conficker C generates 50,000 domain names every day. So the worm's controller would only have to purchase one of those domains in order to communicate with the botnet.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ken on the line in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm really curious to know, where does cybercrime rest sort of in the pantheon of America's popular imagination? You know, it doesn't seem like Hollywood's ever going to pay George Clooney or some other big star $10 million to sit in front of a computer and commit crimes. It just seems too uninteresting, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a dichotomy there. These crimes are so damaging, yet they're so uninteresting. They're so unsexy. Could you sort of comment on that, the popular view of these types of crimes?
I will say, Ken, this is just my opinion. Mark's book is actually quite interesting, but why don't you talk about the interest that you've seen?
Well, Ken is exactly right. I mean, it would be very difficult for Hollywood to dramatize this. I've actually had some discussions because I generally, when I write books or stories, they get options and there's a lot of movie interest. And I was on the phone with a producer who works with Brad Pitt last week. And, you know, they successfully adapted Michael Lewis's book Moneyball, which doesn't strike you immediately as a cinematic storyline. And he had some really interesting ideas. But I do think that while it doesn't strike me, there's an obvious way to dramatize the story on film. It is very fascinating subject matter for a book because there you can sort of delve into the high-level intellectual chess match that's being played. And if you can explain moves and counter moves to certain readers, I think that kind of stuff can be quite dramatic and interesting.
For people who don't know this, you wrote Black Hawk Down, which of course was made into a very exciting movie. I mean, is the process for you as a writer entirely different, or is it essentially the same when you get a story you really love and you trace it down?
It's basically the same. You know, I remember I spent 3 years years ago as a football writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and a lot of the guys who were covering sports then remarked to me, you know, how can you go from covering government and politics, and I at one point was the science writer, to writing about football? And I would tell them, you know, it's exactly the same process. You know, I don't know anything about football, or I don't know anything about the story until I start working on it. And you find the people who know. You ask the appropriately stupid questions and hopefully come out at the end a little wiser.
Is it almost a danger after working on this for a couple of years when you think, I am somewhat an expert on this subject?
Well, I don't know. I never actually get to the point where I feel that that's true. You know, I do arrive at a point where I feel I understand what happened and that I can explain what happened. But to try to compare myself with those who do this for a living, who've been living it in some cases for their whole lives, my level of expertise is very, very small compared to theirs.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, how soon do you think it will be before the malware community moves to financially entice one of the security experts to start working for their side?
Well, I'm certain it's already happened. And in fact, I think that's why Eastern Europe, these countries that were formerly part of the Soviet Union, are such a hotbed for malware manufacture. And it's because they have extremely capable professionals who have no commercial outlet or legitimate commercial outlet for their talents and their skills. I mean, in this country, if you are a really capable programmer, I mean, you can get hired by any one of dozens of major software companies to design commercial software. Those opportunities are not quite as plentiful in China or in Eastern Europe, and that doesn't mean that there aren't people who are capable of doing the work. So where they gravitate is to the illicit software business, and that would include, I'm sure, people who formerly, you know, worked for large corporations in those countries who know their way around the Windows operating system as well as anyone, and now are, you know, getting paid to exploit it.
Yeah, it would seem like the disgruntled former employee is like the most dangerous thing you can have walking around.
Well, it's true. I mean, you have to come by your expertise in some way, and one way is, you know, to have actually worked for one of these big companies that specialize in it.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372 and say hi to Bo in Dallas. Hello, Bo.
Hi. Great topic today, guys.
Thanks.
Can you tell me, I have a couple of questions. One is, can these things be targeted towards smartphones as well, since a lot of those run the internet on them? And then also, maybe it's kind of a sci-fi geeky kind of way to think, but can there not be a program created like a Tron program that's actually a defense, that defends against these things on the Internet?
Well, those are really good questions, Bo. In fact, increasingly, manufacturers of malware are targeting cell phones, smartphones, because so many people are now using that as their primary interface with the Internet. So security precautions are every bit as important on cell phones as they are on personal computers. Conficker actually is tailored to attack the Windows operating system, and to my knowledge, I don't think that's what's running most smartphones, so they wouldn't be vulnerable to Conficker. One of the problems with creating a Tron-like, you know, defense against malware on the Internet is that the Internet is something that sprang up without any central governance. It basically is just, you know, people who have a computer network attaching themselves to other computer networks. And in that sense, it's the ultimate democratic tool. It's an anarchy, essentially. And so it is, while... There are many good things as a result of that. For instance, you know, in countries like China or Iran, or as we saw throughout the Middle East, people can use the Internet to band together as a tool for revolution and reform, and it's outside of the control of any central power. So in that sense, it's the ultimate democratizing tool in the world. But for the same reason that it's out of the reach of authorities, of tyrants, it's also out of the reach of legitimate governments. It's very, very difficult to control. So I think that, you know, one of the things that may have to happen here in the near future is that the Internet will have to be rebuilt from the ground up with security precautions like the one that Bo suggests in place, and also with a sort of central governance in place that allows for more rigorous protection of privacy. And you may have to pay more to use that parallel hypothetical Internet than the one that exists today, but you would be able to do so with a little bit more security.
I don't ever recall having downloaded, say, a security patch for my smartphone. Is that what I'm getting when I'm told that there's a new version of iTunes and I should update?
I think you do. To be honest, Chris, I'm not sure the answer to that, but I know, you know, the manufacturers of those operating systems are well aware of their vulnerabilities, and I presume that part of those regular updates you get includes security.
Have you been following the Stuxnet story?
I have, you know, and that's a fascinating development and is indicative of where I think malware is headed. These kind of attacks, which are called Advanced Persistent Threats, APTs, are unlike Conficker, which was designed to infect as many computers as possible all over the world. These newer attacks are tailored for very specific reasons. And of course, Stuxnet was designed to infect a specific network of computers in Iran that sent their uranium enrichment centrifuges spinning out of control and set back Iran's illicit effort to build nuclear arms by most estimates by several years. You know, that was an extraordinarily successful attack, probably launched by espionage agencies in Israel or the United States or both. And it demonstrated the capability of cyber warfare to cripple an industry in a country. In this case, they, as I said, set back Iran's effort for years. While that may have gladdened our hearts in the Western world, because most of us would prefer Iran not have nuclear weapons, it demonstrates the capability that exists that can be used against us as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Plano, and Bobby's on the line. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, Chris. It's a great topic for this afternoon. Thanks for the topic. I do have a couple of questions for the gentleman. The first one is, actually, I work in an IT industry, and I'm trying to understand, like, if there is novice guys trying to understand what the difference between a worm and virus, what would be your recommendation? That's the first question.
Best way to educate people who don't know, I guess.
Right.
I
think at the outset of the program, I described a worm as a piece of software that can infiltrate your computer's operating system without you doing anything. It does it on its own, whereas a virus is something that you have to essentially let into your computer by clicking on an attachment or an email that comes from a source that you're not sure of.
So this thing is still out there. Is that right, Mark?
It is. The Conficker botnet is very much alive and well. The initial fears that it might be used to generate an enormous denial-of-service attack that could effectively overwhelm the Internet's root servers and shut down the Internet was not realized. But so what that suggests is that the people who created this botnet created it to make money. And so in that sense, they need the Internet for it to be useful. So probably what they're doing, as evidenced by this ring in Europe that was arrested earlier this year, draining money out of American bank accounts, is leasing portions of the botnet to criminal operators for various scams like sending spam or stealing money.
At the risk of miring ourselves in Rumsfeld-style unknown unknowns, should we assume that there are other worms out there that may be operating that nobody has yet detected?
Probably not. I do think the security industry is sophisticated enough to recognize new strains of malware as they appear. Guys like Phil Porras will spot something that's floating in the Internet that's infecting computers. That doesn't mean that they necessarily understand it and they understand and they know who's behind it or they can stop it. Those are things that they were not able to do. I think that while the Conficker botnet has the potential to be used as a weapon, the fact that it has not been used ought not to make us feel that any more secure. Anyone who learned from Conficker can build essentially a weapon that could very seriously disrupt normal operations in this country.
Do you happen to know if university-level computer science programs include ethics courses?
I don't know if they do. I know that they're still relatively new. When Phil Porras went to college, his computer knowledge was so high that he couldn't find. He eventually found one at Stanford. He went looking for an IT course or a computer science course that could teach him something. And nowadays there are computer science departments in most universities. And I don't know if they teach ethics or not, but I'll say this. The people who I met in researching this book who work in this field have a very finely tuned sense of right and wrong and ethics. And, that's why you found these guys, banding together on a volunteer basis.
I'm afraid we are out of time, and I'm so sorry. Mark Bowden's new book is called Worm, The First Digital War. Mark, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.